Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Away we go once again. Today we will be in Revelation chapter 6 and 7. We'll go through part of chapter 7 through, you never know, verse 8 most likely. Possibly into verse 12. Anyways, just depends on how crazy it all gets. So that's, like I said, last week we discussed chapters 4 and 5. We were introduced to the throne room, and we got a very vivid view of what John was able to describe as the throne room in which we believe God to exist. We got a view of Jesus Christ as the sacrificial lambs. The chapters were full of imagery and symbolism, helping us to really understand the power and sovereignty of God and how God's plan, for the most part, continues to work through history, even at times when it seems like it is not. Even at times when it seems like, why is all this evil happening or why are these bad things happening? If we take less of a myopic view and take a step back, we have a better understanding that God is at work, not ever fully knowing what God is doing, but at least being able to better understand that no matter how crazy it gets, and for the people in Rome at the time, or in the Roman provinces who were under Roman rule, this was a message of hope to them that no matter how oppressive Domitian and the other emperors had become, there was still hope, and there was still a sovereign God. And that's what we saw from chapters 4 and 5. As we go into chapter 6, we kind of enter a new section of Revelation, which will take us all the way through chapter 16. The stage at this point has now been set for the opening of the scroll, where the seven seals will be opened. Then we'll also see seven trumpets and seven bulls. And based on how an apocalyptic piece of literature will work, this pretty much is those three things, those three items, the seal, the trumpet, and the bulls, are telling, for the most part, the same thing, just in a different way, which is what you see a lot of times in this type of literature. Now, of course, there are going to be some little intricacies and differences between the three, but they're still pointing to the main message that John is trying to communicate. Through the next section of Scripture, we'll see the righteous judgment of God moving forward. We'll note that the scroll is not opened until all seals are removed, which happens by the end of chapter 7, which unfortunately we will not get to today, but we'll get pretty close to that. Even though the scroll is not opened until the final seal is pulled, each seal is significant, and it shows the preliminary judgments representing forces that have and will continue to operate throughout history, again showing God's redemptive and judicial purposes and how they will be carried out at the end of what we know as the end of time, or like to refer to as the end of time, though for God, I guess there is not an end of time. Or is he even in time? This could be a whole other question, so well beyond the scope of this. Remember, as we go into this, we need to avoid any sort of rigid chronological interpretations of the imagery that we'll be reading about. Apocalyptic literature, as I've mentioned before, is more impressionistic than descriptive, and that was the intent of that type of literature. This means we should not expect anything precise or even what we refer to as logical regarding the writer's message, because it's going to just be so beyond the scope of anything of any reason or logic, no matter how hard many people have tried to make this logical and reasonable and tried to be able to predict things and say things from this, or be able to determine very specific, rigid interpretations that seem to always fail miserably. That was not the point of what John was trying to do here. The Left Behind series was a great entertaining series of what it was, entertainment. It was not really anything that was biblically based, though, yet it was rigid and chronological in its approach, which took a lot of its, not authority, but any sort of relevance out of what they were trying to communicate there. But they made a lot of money, and good for them, and they made an entertaining series out of that. Think of this as much more as poetry, something much more artistic than us trying to look at a scientific or historical journal or historical facts. The three cases of the seals, like I said, the trumpets and the bulls, and sometimes people really try to nitpick and decipher and pick every little detail out and try to think they know what they're talking about, when in fact we're trying to look at a larger message of who God is and what God's redemptive purpose is, and a message of hope. So again, keep that in mind as we go through here, and you know, you can enjoy a lot of the conspiracy theories that come out of Revelation, and you can enjoy a lot of the books that have been written that are not biblically correct or theologically correct in what John was trying to say. And I'm not saying that what everything I'm saying is that either, because there's so many different interpretations that we're doing our best as humans to try to decipher what John was seeing, and then what he interpreted 2,000 years ago, and how to put that into our context today. But since the beginning of when this was written, people seemingly have thought they could figure out the keys to the code, when in fact that's not possible to do. So in the first, we'll deal with the first six seals today. The first four are actually kind of in their own category, and then the next three are in a different sort of group. And of course, the four seals, as we know, are the four horsemen, or the four horsemen and their horses. Through these verses, there's actually about eight different verses. Yeah, the eight verses of the four horses. We're introduced to a pattern that we will see later on, the pattern of four and then three. In chapters 8 and 9, we will see the same with the seven trumpets. And again, in chapter 16, we'll see the same with the seven bulls. The four horsemen have been widely interpreted for centuries, some of the good and others in misleading ways. Most likely would say they represent forces of God operating in judgment throughout history. That's the line that I'm going to go down. Like I said, there's been many different ways that, you know, the horses have been interpreted in ways that have been helpful, and many ways that have not been helpful to help people determine what Revelation is about, or at least how it's relevant to them. John gets the four horsemen most likely from the prophet Zechariah, but switches them up, as he has done with other ideas he's pulled from Zechariah, Daniel, Ezekiel, and others along the way. There's the vision of four horses in Zechariah if you go to chapter 1, verses 18 through 17. Again, in chapter 6 of Zechariah, you'll be able to see that. In Zechariah, the color of the horses seem to be to have no significance. But John does provide some for his horses that he describes, so his horse's color does have significance. The conquest for the white, bloodshed for the red, scarcity or for the black, and then death is pale, or some would say chlorine or chlorinous, I believe is the word that's used in Greek for that. In Zechariah, they're sent out to destroy the earth, while here in Revelation, the release brings disaster to the earth. So two different things, disaster versus destruction. Some have tied the four colors of the horses in Revelation to be consistent with Roman chariot races, the colors symbolizing the four winds of the four corners that for the most part accompanied the official opening of the emperor's reign. So we could see how this relates. And of course, since he's writing this to people in Rome, they'd be able to understand that as well. Less relevant to us because we don't live in ancient Rome. Though we do have some ties in with Zechariah here, we can note here that John is focused on Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels, where Luke records wars and tumults, nations rising against nations, earthquakes, famine, pestilence or plagues, great signs from heaven and persecution. If we were to combine earthquakes and cosmic disturbances, the seven woes that Luke discusses in his Gospel are within the six seals of Revelation. So there are some tie-ins with the synoptics as well as we look through here, especially with what Luke had written. These first four seals are depicted to happen on earth. We will see that the fifth seal, verses 9 through 11 here are tied in, or actually take him back up to heaven. So there's this continues to be this back and forth between visions that relate to earth and visions that relate to heaven. The events set in motion by the opening of these four seals are both bad news and good news. So you can think of it as both judgment and grace, which is true if we look close enough to these. So without any more introduction to these first 8 verses. Let me go ahead and read them here for us, and then we will make our way through this. And remember, it's only the Lamb who can open the seals. There's a lot of exaltation and excitement when people realize that only the Lamb, and it was the Lamb, and the Lamb was there, and he could open up the seals, if you remember that from the last chapter. Then I saw, chapter 6, verse 1, then I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying as with a voice of thunder, "Come!" I looked to behold a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. When he broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come!" And another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, and that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. When he broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature saying, "Come." I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarii, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine." When the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come." And I looked, and behold, an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. Authority was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill the sword, to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. It's quite scary, as you can imagine. If you were a person who lived under Roman rule, this is quite a scary time for them as they were reading this for the first time. That is the Lamb here in verse 1 who begins the opening of the seals. As we know, of course, like from the previous chapter, the Lamb is the only one who can do it. Also, this points to the culmination of human history of what we're looking at here as we go through these seals. The first of the four creatures yells with a thunderous voice to the first horse. Know that each creature calls a horse, not one creature calling all four horses, but each creature calling a horse. It's hard to tell why that happened. I guess maybe that's why maybe John just decided that just made a whole lot of sense, and that's what happened whenever he was observing the work of the Lamb and the four creatures there in the throne room. The first rider, as we see here, is on a white horse, a conqueror who is seeking a conquest. There are a couple of interpretations of the white horse. One is from Irenaeus, who in the late 2nd century would say the rider is Christ and the white horse with the victorious progress of the gospel. So this comes from what we will see in chapter 19, verse 11, where we will see another white horse and a rider there in chapter 19. The rider is referred to as at least is named the Word of God. And we'll see later in the chapter where on his thigh is written King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This could make sense based on the color of white, meaning righteousness and symbolizing righteousness, or going forth to conquer the evil of the world. And looking back at 5:5, where the Lion of the Tribe of Judah has conquered. So there's some validation to that. So if you want to run with that one, run away and run along. Now, there is another, there are others who say that this is not actually the Christ. If we were to compare chapter 6 with chapter 19, we'd see that there is little in common between the riders besides the color of the horse. In this verse, the rider wears a victor's crown and carries a bow, while in 19, the rider wears many crowns and also a sharp sword coming out of his mouth. This verse is about conquest, while chapter 19 is about righteous retribution, two very different things. Also, if the Lamb is opening the seals, how is he also riding out on a horse? Because you'd have to believe that, well, to take that as literal as you want, who knows? The throne room is a crazy place. It could be that the Lamb could be Jesus, and this person on the horse could be Jesus. Take your pick, but I'm kind of still following this line of thought. One other nail in the coffin is that we see the words "there was given," which typically would mean a divine permission was given to evil powers to carry out nefarious works. So we have that inconsistency as well. So where it was given to him there at the end of verse 2 here in chapter 6, that would be something given evil to this, and divine would have to do it. And, well, Jesus is already divine. That'd be difficult to do. One other option that we could look at here, because I know we like options, is possibly it could be symbolizing conquest and militarism. Some would say this is the Antichrist, who is depicted in many different ways in the book. We're not seeing anything that is righteous. It may be this horse on the white, this horseman on the white horse may be trying to mirror righteousness, but indeed it is not. We know the bow is a symbol of military power in the Old Testament. We've seen that. And the crown is a symbol of victory. Remember, God tells Hosea that he will break Israel's bow. In Hosea 1 through 5, so there's just some military pieces to the bow here. Some writers have looked at the bow as much feared invasion of the Parthians coming from the east, so this is something much more closer to their home than for us, as if the Parthians were to come to attack, and they were known to be very good, infamous in their archery, and actually they were also known to ride white horses. And in AD 62, Vologeses, a general for them, of the Parthians, had won victory over the Roman army. So that was, like I said, pretty close to home, and maybe they're thinking, oh, crud, these Parthians are about to take us out, and they're not very pleasant people either. So take your pick on that one of what you believe that to be. verses 3 through 4, we have the second seal, and some people would say this has something tied into war here, and we have the lamb again, and we have another creature as part of this. The opening of the second seal, the second creature is calling out for the second horse. We don't know which creature it is, as it seems again to have no significance if it's, yeah, which is it, the creature with the form of a lion, or the form of an eagle, or the face of a human? It's hard to tell. So now we get a fiery red horse, and if you remember, Carillion is fiery red, so I wonder if it's the same color as a Carillion. It could be. But anyways, it's red, and he's given a large sword, or at least the horseman. I guess it is in plural, not plural, but in masculine form here. So yes, we'll refer to him as a horseman. You can refer to him as a horse person if you'd like. But anyways, the large sword is given to him, and the idea is to be able to take peace away from the earth, and which for the most part allowing even more people to kill each other, which has been going on for centuries, if not since almost the beginning of known history. The red, of course, symbolizes bloodshed and slaughter. The first seal seems to show or suggest invasion from without, while this one is more about internal strife, so think of it probably better said as something about country versus country, or even possibly civil wars. Not being country versus country, but more of internal strife, like civil war or communities, so citizens dividing against each other. That could be another way to depict this based on how it is being written. So that's kind of interesting. And then the sword here, it's not a long sword. It's more the Roman soldier's short sword, of the word that is being used here. And it would make a lot more sense for an internal conflict, because internal conflict, when you're stabbing somebody in the back, you'd much rather use a shorter sword than, of course, if you're in a battle against an invading nation, you'd prefer to keep that person away and have a longer sword to do that. So just some symbolism to continue to show that this is possibly an internal issue. This is not pointing to religious persecution, as some would suggest, but again, strife or issues within communities. This seems to come from Zechariah chapter 14, verse 13, where it is stated that on that day, men will be stricken by the Lord with great panic. Each man will seize the hand of another and will attack each other, again, pointing to internal strife. And our friends, our prophet friends in the Old Testament, were very helpful to John as he put the book of Revelation together. So always keep that in mind. And a lot of stuff that they wrote, especially the minor prophets, was apocalyptic in nature as well. So a lot of symbolism that you can't take literal, but pointing to bigger issues and bigger concerns that they were called to prophesy about. Isaiah also seems to think something similar, but it was between the Egyptians fighting each other. So maybe there is some sort of Egyptian issue going on at the time that he was pointing to. The red horse would resonate with the people in Rome during this time, as there was a significant amount of rebellion and civil disorder. In AD 68 versus 69, there were four emperors in Rome. There were four emperors in that time period, so they kept on killing each other. That's what I mean by that. So this is, if this was written in 90 AD or AD 90, so that would be plenty of time for John to know and record and to get all this down, and so it would make a lot of sense. John was existing at a time of a lot of internal strife there in his part of the world. It feels like this today as tribes are formed, but this is also something that's been happening since the formation, again, of known history of where we've had tribes and tribal warfare. And nowadays we refer to a tribalism as an issue of where people are picking sides here in the West, and we have kind of our own tribes of people that we like to get along with. And there's a lot of social psychology written about that right now, and sociology written about that that is beyond the scope of this. But it's something that has happened since the beginning of time, as where, you know, teams form and they fight each other. verses 5 and 6, we have the third seal. It's a famine that is coming our way, or coming their way. And it is, again, by the third creature. The lamb opens, the third creature calls, the next horse comes. We introduce the black horse, whose rider holds a pair of scales in his hand. I wonder how he rode like that. I guess he could ride with scales in one hand. I guess just like a soldier would ride with a sword in one hand and the reins in the other. We hear something like a voice from the center of the room. Not sure who exactly it is. Guess as much as you want. They don't tell us. But I imagine you can come up with some good conspiracy theories about it. But they announce the famine, announce famine prices for wheat and barley, and warns against hurting the oil and wine. There's some debate about the significance of oil and wine. We'll get here to in a second. We're looking at a time of scarcity when the price of commodities increase significantly. So with all the inflation talk lately, ooh, we can make all kinds of stuff up with that. We see something similar in Ezekiel when the inhabitants would eat rationed food in anxiety and drink rationed water in despair. So again, more references coming from Ezekiel. The denarius was a Roman silver coin, which is equivalent to a day's wage. For this, they could typically buy enough wheat for themselves or eat some of the less nutritious barley for 3 days. So 1 day of wheat or 3 days of barley, barley not being the preferred grain of the time. Based on what we're seeing here, we're estimating that the cost of both the wheat and the barley are probably 10 to 12 times what it typically would cost based on how this is being written. So we take the horse and the rider to be a symbol, to symbolize famine. This would be symbolized as what would happen in warfare in ancient times when conquering armies would come in and live off the land that they conquered. Again, when they're living, when the soldiers and the winning army is living off the land, those who are being attacked are not, and so are living the time of famine and ration. The wine and oil comment limits what the rider horse can destroy. As agrarians, the people reading this would understand that the wheat would all be destroyed, but the wine and oil has deeper roots, which would survive through a famine. So if this is truly a famine, the grapes will return once the famine is over because they have deep roots, and the wine and the oil, the, I'm sorry, the olive trees, or the, which I assume is referring to olive oil, would return as well because of their deep roots. Some people have taken this a little bit further, as in, since oil and wine were probably more for the well-to-do, this is saying that the more well-to-do people will be okay, but the poor will suffer. But that does not hold up whenever you have the other side of the argument that, well, everyone used oil and everyone drank some level of wine, be it date wine, grape wine, some sort of other fermentation of fruit. So probably less about the poor suffering and the rich not. And this, of course, with the poor suffering and the rich not, would be inconsistent with the overall message of the lamb. Others have taken the two elements, and you can, these are probably more of our more liturgical people who actually take sacraments important seriously, and say that believers will not suffer in the famine, but that does not really hold either. It makes more sense to look at this form from probably a natural perspective. What I mean by a natural perspective, meaning that just the way trees are built and grapevines are built, they have deep roots. So that's the route I'm going on. We'll hold even after the famine. So those of you wanting a decision, pick away, but I like to go with the one, especially since I grow a lot of, since I grow grapes. I don't grow, well, I actually just planted an olive tree, so growing that, but several other trees too. So I could see how that could work and play out, unless of course it gets 10 degrees and then none of your citrus survives. Verses 7 and 8. And now we have the fourth seal, and this is the seal of death. This is where you have your chlorine looking like course, which is kind of like a whitish green, I think is what people would refer to it as. Very, very pale, pale in form. The lamb opens the seal, the fourth creature, the fourth horse. Some refer to this as the color of a corpse. Or someone, probably better said, is someone struck with terror about how all the blood has left their face because they were struck in terror. So very pale and white. So the rider of the horse is referred to as death and is followed very closely by Hades. They're given power over a quarter of the earth. This is not a geographical limitation, however, but sets forth more of a quantitative sense. Look at it, it's death over a quarter of humankind is probably a better way to look at this. Again, you pick it as geographical, say, you know, I think all Russia and China's going, that's a quarter of the earth. Now, that's not going to happen, but if you want to pick a geographical limitation, then go ahead and do that. But it doesn't seem like that's what they're talking about here. It seems this is based on the four dreadful judgments that we see in Ezekiel 14. The sword, famine, wild beast, plague, and pestilence coming. The pestilence that is referred to here is based on an epidemic type disease in general rather than a death. So John here uses a little bit different type of sword than he used earlier on with a red horse, but it is still a type of short sword in this case. We again see an intensity where now people are killed by wild beasts, which would make sense in a time of famine, in a time of war, because people would be weak in a time of famine, is the idea behind that, especially back then. You didn't really have nice brick homes to run into when all the wild boars are running around your house. You lived in tents or outside or in not very well-constructed buildings, at least based on our understanding of well-constructed buildings. And they would, you know, or you couldn't run away from them. I mean, there's a whole lot of different issues that they dealt with back then when John wrote this than we do today. Some have taken the second sentence in verse 8 to correspond with all four seals. So with that idea, we've talked about the four seals, and then verse 8 starts kind of a corresponding or an overview of the four seals. This would show us the seer's interpretation of all of the writers. You can go with this, or if you'd like, it is hard to associate wild beasts with the wild horse, but it could work with the others. All up to you. This overview of the four horses and the riders would be better understood if we were to place ourselves in one of the seven churches that we learned about early on in the book of Revelation. To listen as each is being read and avoiding a static assigned interpretation of each horse, but instead to look at the wholeness and the destruction of all four horses. So again, not to nitpick each single horse and determine exactly the significance of each, but to kind of look at the overview of what is happening, overall picture of what is happening with the four horses coming upon the earth. You can imagine that if you were one of those people living at that time and in one of those churches and getting this message, you could just recoil in terror as understanding that war and bloodshed and famine and death are heading your way. Remember, visions are best to be imagined as we look through this and less about being analyzed. And so they were imagining what this possibly could be. They were not nitpicking it to death and trying to, you know, say, well, if I'm a pretty good guy, so it's not going to get me. And If we calculate this the right way, then that quarter of destruction, well, obviously I'm not in that quarter. And so that's not exactly at all what they talked about. It was more of imagined about how horrible this would be for all of the creation. So those of us who are more willing to approach Revelation with a sympathetic imagination will be more able to understand the true meaning. Not that those with a sympathetic imagination would fully understand, but maybe better understand what John is trying to write here. I mean, there's been, as you guys know, there's been thousands of books that have been written about Revelation and so many different commentaries from so many different viewpoints. I only use four or five of them, but there's many more out there. And so, again, up for interpretation, but I do encourage you to come with it with a little bit more imagination and a little less analysis. Okay, verses, the fifth seal of the martyrs, verses 9 through 11. This is kind of, we're transitioning from earth to heaven here. And let me read verses 9 through 11. When the Lamb broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" This is actually not a sad situation. These people have been placed, is understanding. If they're under the altar, is actually a place of they've been raised up. They've been not glorified quite, probably quite at this point, but it's a place of honor for being martyrs is probably a nice way to look at this. In verse 11, and there was given to each of them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest for a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, would be completed also. All right. All right. As mentioned before, we have a division of the seven seals. We had the first four, and now we have these three, starting with the the fifth seal of the martyrs. So the scene changes, like I said, from earth to heaven. We change our view from the writers, now looking at an altar in heaven. We are looking beyond the consummation of human history at this point, and now looking at Christian martyrdom. And so this is really no longer about the end of history, but more about the martyrs who have died for the cause of Christ. Of course, the martyrs have a, not of course, they probably had several other questions, but they did have a really major question on their mind about how long, Sovereign Lord, will they be there? What we quickly will see is that it will get worse there on earth before it gets better. We learned that it will happen in God's time, just like everything else in this world, and creation happens in God's time, even though we'd like it to either happen sooner, later, or not at all. But it will happen in God's time. The idea of heaven being a holy temple is typical of Jewish thought. This is a reference to verse 9. It is hard to determine, it's not necessary to determine if this is the altar of burnt offering or the altar of incense, as those two altars have been well attested to and well spoken of there in the Old Testament. There's a theme of sacrifice that would say it could be for, it could be one for burnt offerings, but then the prayers rising up could be one of incense. We could suggest that John combined the two, which John would likely do and had done with other things when he talked about the creatures and other descriptions that he's made. So it would not be out of the ordinary for him to do that. There continues to be a lot of Old Testament symbolism here. The blood of the bull was poured out at the base of the altar of the burnt offering, as we know that the blood contained the life or soul of the flesh. This points to the martyrs who are under the altar as a way of saying that the ultimate deaths of these individuals are a sacrifice on the altar of heaven, sacrifice to God. We see in rabbinic writings that the souls of the righteous are kept under the throne of glory. It could suggest that the idea of martyrs having reached a place of safety, or I said a place of honor, that's what they could be looking at here. So that could be probably for more of a rabbinic viewpoint. The martyrs had given up their lives because of the word of God and the testimony that they had borne, and God, and they're the ones who gave their lives in faithfulness to God as revealed in and through Jesus Christ and how faithful they were to the cause. John does not know anything about a rapture of the church at this point, so that's not even on his mind, by which Christians are spared the tribulation that normally accompanies a godly life. We would imagine that if he did know about it, he would have mentioned it because it would have helped people listening along a whole lot more. But since he doesn't, it's hard to believe that he knew anything about the rapture or was familiar really with it, at least in this context. It is John's understanding that they ascend to heaven through suffering and death as Jesus did. They are not taken to heaven as a way to escape suffering on earth. So again, we've talked about multiple times about the saving of the people, the grace and that people would see or feel or sense is, or the protection, probably better said, is a spiritual protection. It is not a physical protection that is being referred to. So there's that idea that at the end of time, I'll be taken up to heaven and be spared any sort of pain and heartache. And that's not the promise. It's I will be protected spiritually as long as I remain faithful, as in I will continue to remain a believer in God. And even though things get really hard and I get, you know, possibly martyred and physically oppressed or beaten, spiritually I'll remain strong. And that is what is being referred to here. And that sometimes gets missed over unless you're familiar with the ancient text and how it was written and the intention that he was trying to make based on the original words that were being used to write this. So verse 10, from below the altar, the seer, here's a request for vindication, which we can contrast it between this prayer and that of Stephen's. The first martyr, whose last words were a request that those who were stoning him not to be held responsible for their acts. So remember what Stephen said back in the book of Acts, that they did not know what they were doing. They should not be responsible for their acts. So that's what Stephen said. But here the martyrs are looking for vindication where Stephen did not. Jesus had a similar prayer in Luke 23, similar to Stephen's, not similar to here, where he said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." This does not mean that the martyrs are sub-Christ or are not as faithful as Stephen or going against Christ. This idea of vindication is used in the Old Testament, such as in Psalm 79:10. If you're familiar with a lot of the other Psalms, you'll see there's many times there are requests for God's people seeking vindication against the hordes and the armies that have been attacking them. This does not rise out of necessarily personal revenge, but instead for the reputation of God. And so, again, going back to Old Testament beliefs and Jewish beliefs, is that do not let these people get away with this, not for personal reasons, but because otherwise they will look at you as a weak God. And so that's the big difference here. So it's not get them back because they got me. It is God vindicate us as in order for them to see how powerful you are as the one and only living God. Continuing on, we could also look at this from the background of Hebrew jurisprudence, in which a plaintiff must plead his own case, which we could see here. Condemned in human court, the decision stands unless reversed by a higher court. The real point here is not the relation to the martyrs to their accusers, but to the validity of their faith. And that's what we're really looking at through a lot of this, is faithfulness and a life of faith. We have to also remember that God is the one who is holy and true. He is totally separate from evil. He will vindicate with integrity those who have been given their lives for the cause of righteousness. It's vindication, not bitter revenge. That's the theme here. The question through centuries has been cried out, "How long, O Lord? How long?" And who can... verse 17. Don't worry about that yet. But the how long question has been going on, continues to this day. The inhabitants of the earth is a designation of the human race and its hostility to God. We're still in verse 10 here. We see these people a couple of times in chapter 11, verse 10. They rejoice over the death of the two witnesses. In chapter 13, they're pictured as worshiping the beast. And in chapter 17, they're intoxicated with the wine of the great prostitutes, adulteries. And again in chapter 17, their names are not written in the book of life. And their reason their name is not written in the book of life is because of their lack of faithfulness in God, or lack of faith in God. Again, that is to the end of the question of verse 10, those who dwell on the earth. Verse 11, each of the martyrs are given a white robe. Some will look at this as a reference of being glorified or given spiritual bodies, giving, of course, to them a special honor. There are a lot of options here based on Old Testament understanding, such as in Psalm 104:2, where God wrapped himself in light as with a garment. In the book of Enoch, there's Apocalyptus wrote about resurrected bodies, the righteous garments of glory stored up high in the seventh heaven, not the old TV show that used to be on, but their reference to a seventh heaven in the apocryphal book of Enoch. Here, however, is this book. The white robes are about blessedness and purity. That is what John is pointing to here in Revelation. If you remember looking back at the church of Laodicea, they were to buy white clothing, pointing, of course, to glorified bodies. Some have looked at those who were victims of Nero's persecution. They're given robes of animal skins and attacked by dogs, which would contrast, of course, significantly with the white clothing for glory and blessedness. Those here in the altar or below the altar are now I'm not going to talk about that right now. we can also look at this perspective based on Domitian. Domitian, of course, had a lot of martyred victims based on how evil and angry he was towards Christians. Many were martyred because they would rather be martyred than worship Domitian. It is not about controlling their impatience, again, to these people here, but to rest in enjoyment of their blessedness. So that is the message that we're getting here, is that rest. You've done what you needed to do. It's in God's time. And we have to also remember here that this is coming from a Jewish perspective, where it was believed that a full number of righteous people had to be offered. We see this in 2 Esdras 4, as well as 1 Enoch 47. There are still many yet to be killed for their beliefs, their fellow servants. And so there will be more martyrs until that completeness happens, and this isn't pointing to the 144,000, but until, I guess there was a certain amount who have not been martyred yet, they would remain there under the altar. All right, let's wrap up chapter 6, verses 12 through 17. We have the sixth seal, referred to as terror, or the great earthquake. And we'll see what we know what the Lamb's up to, and we know that he's going to open up another seal. I looked when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree cast its unripe figs when they shaken by a great wind. The sky was split apart like a scroll when it rolled up, and every mountain and island removed out of their places. Please don't take this literally. This is poetry at this point. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, "Fall on us, hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come. Who is able to stand?" And what the question is who is able to stand at the great wrath of God? So, these final verses of chapter 6 come in response to the question of the martyrs who are under the altar. we do not get a time frame, but we do know that there will be a time when they are vindicated. God has already set in motion the chain of events by which his wrath will be carried out on the earth. So verses 12 through 14, we have the opening of the sixth seal. We see that the great cosmic disturbances that are to be heralded, the last days are to begin at this point. People believed that the order of the heavenly bodies is held in God's control. When there is breakdown in this order, they would know that the end of the world is at hand. And so when you have stars falling and you have moons becoming like blood, there's a lot going on here, and of course that means there's a breakdown in order. We see through this again a very typical apocalyptic style, and are not to be taken with complete literalness. It is pointing to the end of the world, but these are not the literal steps. The other end of this should not be taken in too much of a spiritual sense, where we're looking at the fall of political and social structures or societal structures, and having a social revolution through this. So there's another way to look at it. Looking at the symbolism, the earthquake is similar to what we see from God when he descends upon Mount Sinai, where the whole mountain trembles violently. Isaiah spoke of people hiding in caves when God rises to shake the earth. Haggai speaks of this as well, where God comes to shake the heavens and earth. So again, we get some Old Testament prophet references to this. The black wool is pointing to the type of cloth used in mourning, of course, so which is sackcloth, depending on your translation. You may see that a little bit differently as we look through this. The deep red blood of the moon color would be the result of whatever is in the atmosphere that darkens the sun. The prophet Joel would speak of this, where the sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood. So, I mean, is it if you've ever lived in West Texas or in Lubbock, the sky becomes red. It could be that. It's a lot of natural occurrences that we're dealing with here. Not that the actual moon will turn red. It's what's reflecting of the sun and the sky, natural phenomenon that of course could be caused by God, and can happen. But so again, a lot of just symbolism here. Winter figs are easily knocked down from a tree before they're fully formed. I've witnessed that myself as someone who's grown figs. And there's, of course, no leaves to protect them in the winter, so they do get knocked around a little bit easier. The reference to the stars of heaven is from Isaiah, where he spoke of the starry host falling to the earth like unripe figs. To those who lived in the ancient world, the falling of the stars could mean only to them that the end has come, because that means literally the sky is falling. The sky, like a scroll that has been broken in the middle and quickly recedes to both sides. Again, these are just telling us how terrifying this whole thing will be. It's not actually literally saying the skies will roll up on both sides. Now, again, it could happen. Not saying it won't. I'm not sure what that would look like. I mean, I guess, you know, put our imagination to it. It could be very interesting. But it's, again, it's more he's trying to do is tell us how terrifying this could possibly be. The removing of every mountain does not really have any apocalyptic parallel, but could be something that Nahum had suggested regarding the hills melting away. If you were to read Nahum, we don't need to expect the literal occurrences of these events, but we can expect that whatever does happen will be quite the deal, causing people to run for the hills. The unbelievable fear that would push someone to the hills would make the argument that it is about some social and political political upheavals a bit weak. So that's why I say we can't look at this from a social or political way, because of the way this is being drawn out. We say this because there are other times of Revelation where scorching heat or demonic plague does not get the people's attention, much less push them to the hills, mainly because they were too kind of stuck on their own desires and own needs and own wants, that even with demonic plagues, hey, I'm going to stick it out here because whatever thing I'm doing is much better than, you know, trying to get away from this. So what is being referred to here, I believe, must be this awesome and horrific terror that would be hard for any of us to be able to actually put our minds around. Okay, final three verses 15 through 17 here of Revelation. So to keep this clear, this is for those who are not righteous in the view of the Lord, though it seems that the terror is so bad that everyone runs for the hills, that people would rather flee and hide from God than to deal with the judgment of God and wrath of the Lamb. That's probably, that's one argument that you could look at here, is that it's those who are unrighteous that do not know the hope of God, and so they are taking off out of there, and because they do not want to be judged by God. So away they go. Those who are unrighteous will not only dread death, but the fear of the coming judgment. Those of us who are righteous, I shouldn't say those of us, because that's including me, which is kind of arrogant, I guess. Who is righteous? Who is righteous before the Lord? Anyways, John is not covering all of human society when listing the groups, but is more concerned with those who normally feel secure, as in, hey, I can just pay my way through this. Hey, I have enough money to pay my way out of this. Or I'm smart enough to get my way out of this. That sort of thing is what he's talking about. They should no longer feel that way, because they will all be undone. Notice seven groups are listed, which tells us that it is to cover everyone. We always like the number seven because it tells us it's complete or in total. From the highest caste to the lowest caste of society. So it's going to cover everyone within society. And no matter their level of power on earth, they will flee. This is huge based on the amount of power the Roman emperors and generals had on earth. And so to think that even they would be fleeing, because they had all the power, even that some of them thought they were divine, they would be fleeing as well. You have to remember, ever since Genesis and Adam and Eve, people have been hiding from God based on their guilty conscience, leading them to be fugitive of God. All will be judged
who have rebelled against God's authority is what we're seeing here, both those who are righteous and not righteous. But isn't that everyone? So, okay, this is the divine anger that is being faced by the people, pointing to the hideous nature of sin and the divine reaction. So God's reaction, all that has worked against the interest of both God and the human race. So it's not just that we're sinning against God, that it's also sinning against other humans or sinning against God's creation. So it's not just about sinning against God. God doesn't want us to sin against our own humans or his creation. So there's a lot to it. The wrath of God is part of the New Testament fabric. It is not about personal vindictiveness from God or an impersonal process of retribution from God, but more about the response of God's holiness to persistent and impenitent wickedness. The prophets Joel and Zacharias talk of the day of the Lord as both great and dreadful, according to Joel, and a day of wrath and retribution, according to Zechariah. Who can stand goes along with Nahum chapter 1, verse 6. The announcement of the end need not be understood as mistaken opinion of the human race. We have entered the beginning of the end, pointing to the plagues that we're going to see in chapters 8, 9, and 16. Who can stand? And the answer to that is the martyrs and all they represent, those who are righteous. We again understand that the sovereign of God of the universe remains in control. That's what we can see through all this. The cry for vindication from the people point to the belief that God will vindicate himself, as in, you are the one and only, the most powerful God. We're to live with faith, with the assurance that God is in control, because we are certainly not. He is in control against the forces of evil, even though it seems like many times the forces of evil are in control. But the one who defeated evil with sacrificial death, which of course is the Lamb, the sacrificial death on the cross, will return to claim his people and destroy forever the evil that has stood in his way. Well, son of a gun, look at that. We finished chapter 6, and we're going to jump into the first few verses of chapter 7 just because we have the time to do it. So let's see here. We are going to go all the way through this. Yeah, I thought so. Looks like we'll go through verse 8 today. We'll be able to list all these tribes. Oh, that'd be so much fun. And depending on your list, I love lists. Well, I don't love lists as in to-do lists, but I love lists as in like Matthew 1 when it lists the genealogy of Jesus. Those sort of lists I really like. All right, chapter 7, 1 through 8. Before I read it, I'll give a little bit of an introduction to this. We've learned a little bit about all six of the seven seals and are now in an interlude before we are told about the seventh. So we won't learn about the seventh until chapter 8. So chapter 7 is not about a seal at all, but we get a little bit of an interlude, a little dog and pony show, a little sideshow to keep us going and keep us interested. A similar interlude will happen before we learn about the seven trumpets, but not with the bulls, mainly for stylistic reasons, and that's just the way John wrote. So don't think it's he's doing something. This interlude allows for a breath to be taken before we see the seventh seal from what we refer to, as I just referred to as the scroll, but many people have referred to it as the scroll of destiny. And if you want to do dun 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 every time you say that, then feel free to do that, because it sometimes feels that way. Chapter 7 will have two visions, one with the sealing of the 144,000, and that's the one we'll be talking about today, and the other is the blessedness of the great multitude before the throne, which we'll not be talking about today. We'll be talking about next time. That's the second half of chapter 7. A lot, of course, has been written on the subject of the 144,000. We'll take the view that this is a vision of the church, but from two point of views. The first is about how before the trumpet judgment, the last generation of believers are sealed to be saved from the destruction heading to earth and to be brought into the heavenly kingdom. The second that we'll see with the internal blessedness of all believers when in the presence of God, they will see the fruit of their faithful endurance. This is the contrast, the security and blessedness of the faithful to the panic of those who are not faithful. Those who are now fleeing judgment and possibly answering the question from chapter 6 of who can stand is what we're going through as we look through this. So verses 7 through 8, we will witness the sealing of God's servants, also known as the 144,000 of Israel sealed. Do not take Israel as a nation literally here, because that's not what he's talking about. At least I don't think that's what he's talking about. If that's what you think he's talking about, more power to you. Yay, yay. Okay, chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. After this, I saw four angels. We've now left the four creatures, and now we see four angels. At the four corners of the earth, so many fours, holding back the four winds of the earth so that no wind could blow on the earth or on the sea or any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe to the sons of Israel. Follow closely along here, because the way they list the tribes are very interesting. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000. From the, unless you're Boston, Gad. From the tribe of Asher, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. What? Manasseh? From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. From the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joba, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000 were sealed. Man, what does that mean? It's crazy talk, right? Anyways, it's kind of is, but at the same time, there's a lot to this if we really kind of pay attention and spend a little bit of time of figuring out what they're trying to figure out here. Verse 1, we'll start there. That would make sense. The seer has a vision of four angels at the four corners of the earth. Some have taken the four angels as at the four corners as the four horses from the previous chapter. If you want to, there is. Go for it. There is some evidence from Zechariah 6 that it is possible, based on the reference to the four horses and the four winds of heaven that he uses. It is typical in apocalyptic literature for angels to be in charge of the forces of nature. We learn of an angel in charge of the weather in chapters... Sorry, not the weather. There are probably angels in charge of the weather. I would assume so. And there is a council. But anyways, in charge of the water from chapter 16, verse 5, and in charge of fire from chapter 14. So angels are in charge of very important and sometimes scary things if used in a way that would not be pleasant. The four corners are most likely from all directions, as it is hard to determine if they really thought the earth was square or rectangular at this time. Many believe that they most likely thought of it as probably more of a, of course, it was flat. Many thought it was flat until well further along in history, but it was a round disc. Four winds in this type of literature are typically destructive agents of God, so he's just kind of setting up everything they would know about what this would mean to be bad. In a natural sort of way. We see in Daniel 7:2 where the winds churn up the great sea, and is also from where the four great beasts come from. I would encourage you to go back and read chapter 7, because if you read chapter 7 of Daniel, chapter 7 of Revelation, and even all the chapters up to this point, would probably make a little bit more sense. In the case we are dealing with here, the winds are being held back until the seal of the faithful is complete. The trees here could symbolize a precarious way of life, since trees... And again, it depends if you live in the Texas panhandle or where you live, but trees are easily toppled by high winds. If you live down in a hurricane area, you see the palm trees going down sometimes. You know, so you can take that in our world. People would understand this reference based on their climate, and that what is referred to as the Sirocco winds that blew through that area, which typically caused a significant amount of agricultural destruction, which blew out of the southeast. So all this is kind of making sense to them based on what they know and where they live geographically. Hosea and Zechariah both make references to this type of wind as drying up springs and wells, which of course is hard to farm when your springs and wells are dried up, especially by that crazy little Sirocco wind that would come around and blow everything away. Based on this reference, from John would say he is pulling from an Old Testament source and incorporating it here. It seems to be coming from either earlier Jewish thought based on the listing of the 12 tribes of Israel. A more recent version of this would most likely not mention the tribes, as in if he was pulling this from a more of a Christian perspective and less of a Jewish perspective, you'd probably not have the tribes. We are not sure what his source would have been in a literal sense, but we could suggest that he knew of his prophecy from ancient Israel texts and then adopted it to his current situation. So from a literal Israel to a spiritual Israel is probably a better way to look at this. With all that said, we could just take everything that John said at face value and move on. So If that is what you are inclined to do, move on, my friend. We are introduced here in verses 2 and 3 to another angel coming up from the east and calling to the four angels to continue to hold back the winds and all the other crazy things that are about to happen. Some see the reference to the east as just some description to add to the flavor of the story, while others look at this as something coming from Ezekiel 43:4, where the glory of God enters by the gate facing east. This could be something related to the wise men coming from the east. That's a fun one, I thought. Or that the sun rises in the east and is natural connection to have a divine blessing as well coming out of the east, because that's where the sun is, and the sun's a blessing because it's so sunny and nice. What we know is that the east is from the direction of Palestine. Throw those conspiracies out there and see what you get. The seal is most likely a signet ring, so something that they'd been used to authenticate or protect official documents. Of course, they'd have the seal and the ring. They'd push it against a wax that would then seal and then, of course, say that this is official and important and authentic. We'll learn from chapter 14 that the seal is his name and his father's name, him being here the Lamb and the Father is the seal. We also learned that those who follow the beast will have their own seal, the name of the number of the beast, on their forehead or right hand. So, I don't know. If you got those shots, make sure it's not something forming on your right hand, huh? Am I right? The mark of the forehead is from Ezekiel 9, where the righteous in Jerusalem who are deeply troubled by the sins of the people will have an X placed on their forehead to protect them from the coming judgment in the city. I looked at this similar to something that you see in the Passover, that whenever denied a Passover, you put the blood on your doorpost, and of course, death would pass over. So the idea of the seal is to ensure protection for all believers in the coming judgment. But this happens after the first six seals tells us believers are not spared from the issues the whole earth will face. They are sealed from wrath, like I said, but not great trouble and suffering. So they're sealed from spiritual but not physical suffering. I'm going to stick with that one for a while. The reference to the living God is consistent with the Old Testament. Again, I'm here in the first three verses of chapter 7. similar to this idea of the living God is where, like in the Old Testament text, where you'd see when Israel crosses the Jordan and Joshua tells the people that the living God is among them. The title of the living God happened anytime God was about to intervene in something. This is, of course, to contrast with the false gods of the pagans, who, of course, are not living, but never have lived and are dead. Remember that the servants, or how can you be dead if you're never living? So never existed, or they existed, I guess, in people's minds, but they were never, like, living as God is living. Remember that the servants of God is not a select group singled out from other believers to receive the seal of God. It is instead all of the faithful believers that are alive when these events take place. So it's not a group above. It is not someone who is, or a group of people who have been set on pedestals. This is everyone who is faithful in their beliefs. Notice how the angel refers to them as servants of our God, implying, I love this, I just love anytime you throw angels and humans together, is that humans and angels are fellow servants in the service of God. I just think that is so cool, because sometimes we get a little haughty down here. Not down here. What am I? What is this? 2,000 years ago when I think the earth is flat? When we get on earth, when you get a little haughty about thinking that, hey, we're the big deal, when actually there's like angels and other beings and things too that you read about in the Bible that are legit. Anyways, verses 4 through 8. Let's wrap up this bad boy and get going here. John does not see, but hears the number. Notice that sometimes we think he sees, but hears the number of those who have been sealed. Some have looked at this as a literal reference to Israel. Some believe that even though genealogies are a bit messed up at this time, God knows who the true Jews are. Another was the tribes were still in existence, but in hiding. I mean that the genealogies were a bit messed up. You have to remember. Well, let's go. I don't want to go there yet. Okay, so the viewpoint of this being only a Jewish is inconsistent with the New Testament themes. As a Jewish tradition, Jewish nation no longer existed as it did in Old Testament literature. And the reason I say that is, if you remember, 10 of the 12 tribes, which would be referred to as the Northern Kingdom, were destroyed and taken away by the Assyrians. And the other two, were pretty much destroyed or no longer organized when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. The number 12 is just too tidy. It is just too much to be anything but symbolic. The idea is that the 12, the number of tribes, is multiplied by the thousands implies completeness. And that's something that's pretty typical whenever you see thousands or tens of thousands in texts like this. We could make take that as those who remain and are faithful at the end of human history in this group is one way to look at it. So the 144,000 is a number of completeness because show us that the people who remain at the end of earth and remain faithful to God have taken up Israel's inheritance. Remember, that's why Jesus came, because Israel failed at doing what it was supposed to do of being a separate nation of God and showing the rest of the world who God is. That's why Jesus is here, came to this earth. Again, it does not protect them from death, but it does allow entrance into the heavenly kingdom. So these 144,000 or these faithful, and all who are faithful aren't all of a sudden sucked them to heaven and happy day, though that is a happy day when that happens. But there's a lot of many of them will die like the martyrs did or in some other way. There are multiple references in the New Testament where the church takes on the role of Israel. So to say that the church is now Israel is not the ordinary and is not something that is I'm making up. Israel as a nation, as it existed in the Old Testament, is no longer true. Though there is a place called Israel and there are Jews who live there, it's not what the original intent was. And so that's how it is. Romans 2:29, it says where true believers is the true Jew. Paul's making a reference there in Rome. And in Galatians 6:16, Paul again says where the church is described as the Israel of God. In 1 Peter 2:9, where the church is referred to as a royal priesthood and a holy nation. Again, Israel being a holy nation, but failed at that. Again, why Jesus is here. Again, not everyone who agrees who the 144,000 are, and I imagine most people listening to this are not in all in agreement. So some would restrict them to the portion of the entire church who are martyred in the last days. So if you want to pick that, you can. In chapter 6, those who cried out for vindication were told to wait until the full number of their fellow servants would be killed. This is supported by reference to the prophetic role of the two witnesses in chapter 11 and the 144,000 in chapter 14. Like I said earlier, I'm not fully on board with that idea that the argument for the martyrs is not conclusive, in my opinion. The reason being, again, with the 12 tribes and the symbolism of the number shows completeness. When 1,000 is used, it could also and does mean all or at least too many to count. So I think it's really looking at those who are faithful. Also, it seems that based on chapter 13, all believers will face some level of martyrdom in the last day, which is something that I wouldn't be surprised happens. Notice in the listing of the 12 tribes, there are some irregularities. First, being that Reuben is not mentioned first. Oh, and Reuben should be because he's the oldest, but he's not. So that's one thing. And instead, it is Judah. Huh, why could it be Judah? I know you guys all know because Jesus came from the tribe of Judah, so it makes sense that he would be the first one. We get Manasseh, who is one of Joseph's son, and here as well, but Dan is left out, and some have said that it was mistaken for Manasseh if it were written as man. So if you were to look at the original Greek text, they shortened the name of Daniel, and people had mistaken it for Manasseh because those two letters are actually pretty similar, man and Dan. And if that were true, problem solved. Most likely, though, again, however you want to look at this, Dan was removed based on his connection with idolatry when the tribe of Dan went north, settled in Laish and built an idol. And if you were to go to Judges 18:30, you'd see that. And so at that point, kicked out of the name of the tribes, or at least wasn't allowed to be part of the rest of the group. Some people like Irenaeus, again, that Dan was removed because he was tied to the tradition of the Antichrist. And this is based on some rabbinic teachings that you'd see from Genesis 9:17 and Jeremiah 8:16. You'll notice there are several other variations in the list when compared to the variations in the Old Testament, none matching the order here. At the end of the day, it does not matter, as it was trying to communicate that the 144,000 are all faithful believers about to enter the final period of the history of Earth. So that's where we're going to stick with today. That's where we're going to put a pin in it and move on and get ready for the next half of chapter 7 next time we meet. But always just keep this in mind about the faithful that who are being spoken to here. It is a message of hope, and it's a message of soon to be peace, and that there is a sovereign God who is over the all of history. And so that's what we need to keep in mind as we continue to navigate our ways through Revelation. So next time we're going to wrap up chapter 7, do chapter 8, and probably that's it. And then we'll start learning about more of the trumpets as we go into chapter 9 and 10, probably do those together and continue forward. So anywho, hope everyone has a great rest of their week. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.